this morning. A little cool outside, so. But I'm not sure it's not cooler in here than it was out there in the parking lot. But it will warm up as we get all this body heat in here. I believe the coldness has affected us a little bit, so far at least, on bodies coming in. Maybe we'll have several come in as we get started. Jonathan Furlow, you're standing up, so that's a good position to pray. Did you know it? Would you like to lead us in an opening prayer this morning? Do what? Well, yeah, you could say, well, no, I don't believe I want to do that. Amen. Thank you. Jonathan's statement, do I have a choice? Reminds me of years ago being a Bible major and sitting under one of the professors was Brother Lemoyne Lewis. Some of you may have known Brother Lemoyne and sat with him. He was one of the greatest orators I ever sat under. But he had lecture. He had a big class, big lecture hall. And he would lecture like this the whole time, little short man, but he never took his eyes off the floor. He didn't believe in eye contact. And he would lecture to that floor the whole time. But it was so rich, everything he said. But when he'd get around to giving advice, he always called us boys, preacher boys. And I remember one day we were studying on in the book of Acts and was talking about the Ethiopian nobleman making his confession and the confession of faith, and he stopped and he said, now boys, he said, I want to just tell you. He said, when you get out and you go to preaching and somebody responds to the invitation, wants to be baptized, he said, you take their confession down there on the floor before you get up into the baptistry. Most of the churches were built with the baptistry, had stairs. He said, take the confession down there on the floor. Ask them to, if they believe on the floor. He said, two reasons. He said, number one, if you don't, he said, you're liable to forget it. You get nervous and you're liable to forget to ask them. He said, but number two, he said, just think about it. He said, what if you wait till you get down into the water and you look out to the crowd and you say, do you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God? I said, what are you going to do if he says no? He said, you look like a fool. You got wet for nothing, he said. So I thought of that when you said, do I have a choice? So maybe I didn't learn from LeMoyne. You may not supposed to put people on the spot like that. They might say, no, I don't want to lead the prayer. But we appreciate you doing that. Okay, we've been looking. This will be our second Lord's Day to look at Titus, the letter that the Apostle Paul wrote to Titus. We looked at 1 Timothy. We'll be coming back and looking at 2 Timothy. After we complete Titus, you say, well, why didn't you do 2 Timothy after 1 Timothy? And if you remember, we talked about it. This is the sequence in how we believe the books were written. We know that 2 Timothy is the last book that Paul writes before he dies. So we've got to assume Titus was written before that. So we're going to look at Titus, and then we'll zip back over to 2 Timothy. It won't take us too long to get through Titus. It's a pretty short letter. Apostle Paul writes it to him. Where is Titus? You remember? He's over at Crete. C-R-E-T-E. He's at Crete. Timothy was at Ephesus. Titus is at Crete. There are lots of similarities between the letters, and I think that's one of the reasons it's good to look at all three of them, to realize that the instructions that Paul gives Timothy and the instructions that he gives Titus, how similar they are. They're the same. And to realize there's a pattern here, that it's not just Paul's thinking for the church at Ephesus or the church at Crete, but this is his plan, this is his desire, this is his picture of how he wants his church to be in all locations. Three big issues at Crete, and really they're pretty much the same three big issues over at Ephesus. First one is, there is a lack of spiritual leadership. Lack of leadership when it comes to the spiritual guidance. That's why he says you need to set that church in order. Complete, fulfill the deficiency that's there. He's saying the churches are lacking in something. And he says the thing they're lacking in is this spiritual leadership. So he says you need to appoint elders, and you do it in every city, every church. So that's the first thing, spiritual leadership, elders. Second thing is there are false teachers. In Crete, there were false teachers in Ephesus. And he tells Titus, that's one of your roles, that's one of your responsibilities, that's one of your jobs, is to deal with the false teachers, and they need to be stopped. You don't put up with it. You cannot allow it to continue. If you'll remember last week's lesson, when Paul's talking to Titus about elders, he says one of the things, right there at the end, he says one of the things they need to be able to do is to teach so they can clearly educate the congregation on the truth, and they need to be able to go up against and to stop, to refute, to rebuke the false teachers. And then Paul says the only way they can do that is if they have a knowledge of the truth. So he's saying that is a role of the elders, that's a role of the preacher that's left there, is to deal with the false teachers. And then the third thing is there's some immoral behavior, immoral conduct that's occurring in Crete, and he has to deal with that. Those are the three big things. There'll be others, but those are the three biggies that we're going to look at and we're going to see and observe as we go through Titus. Now, last week we looked at the first nine verses of chapter 1. Today we're going to pick up with verse 10. Last week's lesson was dealing primarily with the spiritual leadership in the congregation, or the lack of. Today he's going to deal with the false teachers. And he starts out and he says, there are many rebellious people. Rebellious. They are rebelling. And I don't mean to be too elementary, but what does it mean to rebel? What does it mean? I don't mean that as a you dummy question. I used to hate teachers that would ask me in school the you dummy questions. You know what a you dummy question is? It's a question that you could tack you dummy on the end of it and not change the meaning or anything of the question. Such as, you had one teacher used to do this, say, class, who was the first president of the United States? It was George. You know, and I'd want to say Jones, a country singer or something. But it was Washington. And I used to think that was a you dummy question. You could say, class, who was the first president of the United States, you dummy? You see, that doesn't change the sentence at all. In my opinion, doesn't change the flavor of it at all. So I don't mean to do that, but I do want us to think about what rebellion is. To dispute against, take a stand against, and what is totally against? Totally against. Opposition. When we think of rebellion today, don't we kind of think of street riots and people that are marching and going out and saying we're against the government, we're against whatever this is, we're against the abortion, or we're against people that are against abortion, and you have this rebellious attitude that takes place. And it's not just an opposition or anything, but it's really taking action on it. A lot of people are against something, and in their heart they don't like it, and in their heart they are opposed to it. But I think when it elevates to the degree of rebellion, they're doing something about it. They're out there and they are manifesting that feeling that they have, and it's exhibited. Paul says there's lots of those people around. Many rebellious people. And he's going to give us some categories, some groups, so we can recognize who they are. He said some of them are mere talkers. The older translations say they are vain talkers. If it's vain or vanity, Solomon spent a whole book in the Old Testament talking about vanity. Remember that, Ecclesiastes? Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. All is vanity and a striving after the wind. I think that was very poetic, what Solomon said. Did you ever try to chase the wind? You get out there and it's windy and you say, I just believe I'll catch it. Yeah, in your dreams, you're fast enough that you can chase the wind. And if you were that fast, how do you plan on grabbing hold of it when you get to it? You can't do it. And that was Solomon's point. That's vanity. It's silly. It's useless to think that you can do that. The language here, the Greek for this word of talking mere talkers is vain. It's vanity. There's no purpose for it. There's no meat in it. There's no logic to it. It doesn't make sense. They're just talking. You know folks like that? You know? And they really don't know what they think or what they believe. I remember sitting in a elders meeting one time, and I was sitting there as an elder, and a fella had come in and he was upset. And we were listening. I was trying real hard to listen to him so we could try to help him. But he just went in circles, and he went here and he went there, and for a minute he'd be saying this, and then in a second he was taking the opposite stand to it, and it was just going on and on. And finally, politely, I said, hold on a minute, brother. I said, I'm confused here. Are you for this or are you against it? And, you know, he kind of smiled. I don't think anybody ever slowed him down to ask a question like that. And I said, are you for it or against it? And he smiled and he said, you know, I hadn't decided yet. I'll know when I get through talking. And I realized he wasn't here to convince me. He was trying to convince himself. He was talking himself working through this. And it was just, a lot of it would be vanity. I mean, there was no point. There was no coherent, no cohesiveness to it. Paul says, beware of people that just want to talk for the sake of talking. They like to hear their voice. They don't think through it. They're just repeating what they've heard other people say. Kind of like that preacher that went off to hold a gospel meeting somewhere, and after the first night, he was standing out in the lobby and people were coming by and they were saying the things that you really want to hear as a preacher. They said, good job, good presentation, fine delivery, good biblical thoughts. And finally a fellow just kind of stumbled up to him and shook his hand, looked him in the eye and said, preacher, the sermon stunk. And he just walked off. Well, the local preacher was standing there and he was so embarrassed. He wanted to try to smooth it over. And so he told the visiting preacher, he said, listen, don't worry about that guy. I said, he really doesn't have good sense, doesn't think through things. And said, in fact, said, all he does is go around repeating what he's heard other people say. Well, that's kind of that vain talker. Just repeats what he's heard other people say. Bill? Sounds like Washington, huh? Okay. There could be a lot of vain talk that's done in Washington and Austin and City Hall. It could be taking place, okay? But then he says there are those that are deceivers. And they evidently do it on purpose. That is their goal in life. Is I'm going to come in and I am going to deceive people. I'm going to... Well, y'all tell me, how do you deceive people? If you're going to set out on a path to deceive someone, what would be your plan of attack? Sorry? Slow and easy. Okay, slow and easy. If you do it all at once, the harsh, throwing it on me at one time, I'll probably react to that. I would recognize that. But you don't recognize the slow and easy, and I'd add to that steady, continual. But if you're going to deceive people, well, number one, I think you're going to try to confuse them. You got to get things to where it's so confusing that you decide what I've always thought was right, I guess is not right. It's more confusing than I thought. And it's not as easy to come to the truth as what I thought it was. And so that's the first thing you do is you confuse people. You affect their confidence. Next thing that you would do is you come in and you tell them, you know, there are other options. There are other options. Think about the way things have made their way in and infiltrated our society, our culture. Changes that have taken place in my lifetime. Nearly every one of them, you can see a pattern. They come in and they tell you, first of all, this is just an alternative. It's an alternative lifestyle. It's just a different choice. So there are several choices. That's the first thing you do. Kind of goes into what Jim says. It's got to be slow and easy. Then after you've had that and felt that and gotten to the point where you can kind of accept that even maybe, then you come in and say, okay, if there are alternatives, let's look at the two alternatives and let's decide and let's realize that this is as good as this. This is the one you've been holding on to, and this is what you've held all your life. But this one is not only an alternative, but it's every bit as good. It's equal. Can we have equal rights to it? Okay? And then the last stage, always, if you look at it, before it's over with, it's not enough that you accept it's an alternative. It's not enough that you accept it's equal. Now you've got to say, really and truly, it's better. It's better. Because someone who can hold that position, they have come to grips with themselves. They've come to grips with the world. They have a bigger view. They've got all this. And so we've moved from it being an alternative to it being equal to now it is better. That's one route of deceit. You follow me, Bill? Too much information. That's that confusing. There's just too many options out here, too much. And so we get to where we just can't process it, and we don't want to deal with it anymore. Don't want to deal with it. And the key is, do you accept it? You've got mere talkers or vain talkers, deceivers, and then he says, especially, remember, let's go back and plug it into this context that Paul is writing to Titus on. He said, especially among are those of the circumcision group. Now, who's the circumcision group? Well, yeah, but I don't think it's so much those who have been circumcised, which is the Jews. But it's those who are pushing that. It's what preachers and commentators would refer to as the Judaizing teachers. That's who that is. Who are the Judaizing teachers? Judaizing teachers were those that felt for the Gentile convert that, okay, he can become a Christian. They accept that very cautiously and very reluctantly, but they've had to come to the terms that yes, the gospel is for all. And so they've accepted Gentiles can be saved, but they believe and they teach, not only do they believe, they teach that if a Gentile wants to become a Christian, he must first do it the same way a Jew did. In other words, he's got to become a Jew, then a Christian. And he's not going to get in any easier than what they've had to go through. And one of the things they've gone through was the covenant of circumcision and all of the rituals that went with it. And so the Judaizing teachers were those that were teaching that the Gentiles had to be circumcised. And they were referred to as the circumcision group. Okay? And that's how they were referred to. The Judaizing teachers. Paul opposed the Judaizing teachers his whole ministry. Because he said, that's not required, and that's not what's necessary. And that's why he wrote things like it's neither Jew nor Greek. It's neither circumcised or uncircumcised that's important. And Paul was still a Jew. Paul was a devout Jew. He was schooled. He studied under the feet of Gamaliel, which only the elite, only the privileged got to do that. And if you remember Paul, when he talks about his early life as Saul of Tarsus, he said, there was nobody any more zealous than I was for the Jewish faith. But yet, Paul, as the preacher says, that's not what's important. It's not circumcision nor uncircumcision. And he fought that all of his life. Now, talking about Brother Lemoyne Lewis, if you get me started on Brother Lemoyne stories, there's just hundreds of them. But he used to tell us too. He said, now Paul, although he was a devout Jew, he spent his career, his life, talking against Judaizing teachers. And he said, but I believe, he said, even though Paul continually talked. See, when I do LeMoyne, I automatically start doing his gestures. But he said, even though he continually taught against the Judaizing teachers, he said, I still can't see Paul on his day off going down to the Dixie Pig and ordering a ham sandwich. He said, I just don't think he did it. And I think he was right on that. And his point was, your rathers, the way you prefer it to be, or the way you were even raised that it ought to be, if it comes down to between your rathers and what truth is, you've got to put truth first. And your rathers have got to come back. Even though you personally may never order that ham sandwich, if you please, you can't impose that on other people. And how many times Paul taught that and expressed that through his teachings. But he said, that's who you've got. Now, verse 11, Paul tells Titus, this has got to be stopped. They must be silenced. Today, in our world of tolerance and moderation, or actually not moderation, just tolerance, we have the attitude, oh, just leave them alone. Just don't listen to it. Don't fight it. Just ignore it. And it'll go away. Or nobody's going to listen. Or it won't affect it. But what did Paul tell Titus and Timothy? He told him, what did he say about those who were deceivers, vain talkers, and who were stirring up the congregation there? And that's the setting. It's the church at Crete. What did he say about it? Shut them down. They need to be silenced. He said, this cannot be tolerated because they are ruining entire households by teaching things that ought not to be taught. And he said, do not allow that. A little leaven, Jesus says, leavens the whole lump. And that's what Paul was saying here. He says, Titus, that's got to be stopped. That cannot be tolerated. That cannot be permitted. You cannot just ignore that because there are entire households that are being ruined because things are being said, things are being taught that ought not to be taught. And he says some of them are doing it for dishonest gain. Some of them are getting money somehow out of it. And they're coming in and they're getting a financial benefit out of it. And he said that makes it even worse. But he says, as Floyd said, you got to shut it down. Okay? Any thoughts? Jim? That's what he said. Last week's lesson, the elders need to be men of the word, that knowledge of the word, so they can deal with this. But right now they don't have elders. And so he's telling Titus, you got to handle it. You got to stop it. But that's exactly right. This is the role of an elder, of an eldership. Not of a head elder, but of an eldership. That's what the role is here. And that's why, again, it's not today's lesson, but when we left Timothy over at Ephesus, Paul, his last visit with the Ephesian elders, if you remember in the book of Acts, he's on his way to Rome. He's never going to come back through there, but he takes time to get the elders to come meet him, and he meets with the Ephesian elders. He's close to this group. It's obvious from the context that both they and he know they're never going to talk again in this life. And the thing that he told them to do, he said, beware. Beware of wolves in sheep's clothing. That they will come in and they will affect the flock. They will attack the flock. And he said, beware of them. He said, in fact, he said, some of them may pop up among your own group. And it's got to be dealt with. Okay, so that is the role of shepherding. Shepherding, there again, in today's society, and I think it's why some churches are where they are today, is we swing things too far from the left to the right, and we never get the balance. But some have looked and said, you know, through the years that the elders have turned into just administrators, and that's all they want to do is administrate. And they're supposed to be shepherds. And we put on the shepherd's hat and says that means you're supposed to be in the hospitals and on the front porches and counseling. Well, that is part of it. But some churches have said that's all they need. That's the role of it. That's the role. Well, part of Psalm 23, when you look at the role of the shepherd, was protecting the sheep also from attack. Okay? That's part of it. Part of the role is a protection from an attack. And the attack that Paul talks about with the Ephesian elders are wolves that wear sheep's clothing. Okay, got to move. But he says they got to be silenced. They're ruining whole households. They teach things they shouldn't do it. Some of them get dishonest gain. Even one of their own prophets has said, Cretans are always liars, evil brutes, and lazy gluttons. That's pretty tough there. You say, well, I'm glad Paul wasn't saying that about them. He's saying one of them said it. One of their own poets, one of their own philosophers said that. And we don't know for sure who it is. Most commentators try to put a name in there of a fellow that was looked upon as one of the seven most influential, highly regarded brains of the day. But I'm not going to go there because we can't prove that's who it was. But somebody said that. Well, before you get too excited that Paul's not the one that said it, he said, testimony's true. There's a lot of truth to it. One of their own people, one of their own brain trusts that they look to, made this statement, and Paul says, you know, it's a true statement. You say, why would he say that? Why would he say that? I believe it's for that third category that he's going to spend some time talking about, and that's the immoral behavior that's taking place there in Crete. Crete, if you look at the history and the background of Crete, it was regarded as one of the most evil spots in the world at that time. When it came to immorality, when it came to just absolute a base kind of life, Crete was the spot. That's where you'd want to go to. Isn't that lovely? Wouldn't you love to be Titus? And that's where Paul left you to preach, was to a bunch like that. But Paul knew they needed help, and there is a church there. There are Christians there, and there's a church there that he tells Titus, you need to set it in order. And there again, you need to set some men in place that can handle these things that are going on around them. But he says, even one of their own people that lives in Crete, even one of them said, this is a sorry bunch around here. And Paul says, that's right. It is. So he said, therefore, because of that, for that reason, rebuke them how? Sharply. Now, does that mean mean? Does that mean a fist fight? Does that mean wrestle them around the room? No. If you do linguistics on this sharply, what it means is you do it with clarity. And you do it with strength. And you don't let them back you down. You hold your position. You be sure that you are grounded in the truth. And that you're grounded in the faith. But if you're grounded, you stay in position and you don't relent. You don't back down. But you look them in the eye and you say, this got stopped. This got stopped. He said, you go and you rebuke them and you do it sharply, intently, continually. So that they, why? Folks, there's lots of patterns in the New Testament. We know that. But even if you want to pull in the Old Testament with the disciplines and the punishments that took place, every time you find discipline talked about in the Bible, it is there to bring about a change. It is there to move people to repentance. It's there to shake them up, to wake them up, to try to move them to a position where they will finally look at what's real and look at faith and look at the Bible and look at truth. That's the point. That's the purpose. Remember when Paul is writing and says, if your brother, or Jesus says the same thing, if your brother has sinned against you, if your brother is involved in something he ought not to be involved with, what did he say do? You go to him and you talk to him. You plead with him. You cry with him. You try to reason with him. If that doesn't work, you take somebody with you to help you. Maybe they'll listen to them. If that doesn't work, you take it to the entire church and you say, this is what's going on. Can anybody, does anybody here think you can have an effect, you can have an impact, you can get through to this individual? If you can, you need to go do it. And Paul says, if that doesn't work, then you treat them as a sinner, as a publican. You don't even eat with them. You say, well, that's harsh. Yes, it is. But why do you do it? The discipline is there to shake them up. It's there to make an impact on them. It's there. The discipline is for redemptive purposes. That's what it's for. Now, it's also so that a little leaven doesn't leaven the whole lump. It also refers to what Paul's telling Titus here. You can't put up with that inside the church, or it's going to ruin the whole church. It may be false teaching. It may be bad behavior. That's what was taking place over at Corinth. Paul wrote to them and said, you've got somebody right there among your number that's living in this debased, immoral situation, and everybody knows it. And you're all puffed up about it. In other words, you're okay with it. And what did Paul say? He said, you ought to mourn. It ought to move you to tears. The discipline was there for redemptive purposes. You with me? Every time. Had a double-edged sword. It was to protect the congregation and protect the integrity of the truth, but it was also to try to redeem the person to come back. Okay? Same thing here. He says, rebuke them sharply. Why, Paul? So that they will be sound in the faith. Maybe the best way to deal with an enemy of Jesus is to make him a follower of Jesus. You realize that? That's the best way. That's what happened to Saul of Tarsus. The best way to combat someone doing bad things and ugly things against the church is to convert them to Christ and let the Lord add them to the church. It's the best way to do it. Then they're no longer fighting, but they're following. And that's the point here. And then he says, pay no attention to Jewish myths. Jewish myths, old wives' tales. Just your horoscope, you know, the Ouija board, or whatever you want to go to. He said, don't pay attention to that. No value in that. No profit of that. Or to the man, to the commands of those who reject the truth. He says, if you've got somebody who does not accept Jesus, somebody who does not accept the Scripture as being the authoritative Word of God, then why in heaven's name would you listen to their advice? Why would you listen to their commands? Why would you let them be an expert on anything? And that's what Paul's trying to bring clarity to. A lot of it's common sense when you get down to it. But you know, Solomon back in the Old Testament, back in the wisdom literature, as we call it, he warns, he says, you know, you need to be careful who you seek to be your advisor. Be careful who you seek to be your advisor. It's really kind of intriguing who people turn to sometimes for advice. It really is. On even spiritual things. If somebody is a celebrity and somebody's got their picture in the paper and on the front of magazines, we think all of a sudden, you know, they get up and endorse a political candidate. Well, you know, that's good, but what in the world does he or she know about what's going on over here? They're making movies. And they were, last week, they were caught for possession of drugs. And they've been locked up several times. Or somebody's got a talk show, and so evidently they're an expert. So we're going to let them help us with our marital issues. Man, they may have been married 8 times. Why would you do that? Solomon says, be careful who you turn to be your advisor. Paul tells Timothy, he says, pay no attention to these Jewish myths or to the commands that come from those who reject the truth. He's trying to help Titus, help the church at Crete. And some very practical advice that he's giving. All right, we started 3 minutes late, but we're going to stop on time. If you look, it's 9:45, so appreciate you being here, and we'll take a little short break.